Okay, this is the 12th recording in our series. Me, Bob Dobbs, and Cameron McEwen. And we're looking at my charts, which are a background to my present book on what we didn't know about Donald Trump. And Cameron indicated he wanted to say something about what we're doing.
Yeah. So I just wanted to make a couple comments about the formula chart that we're leaving off in order to go over to the tiny note chart. And the first thing is that the in order to appreciate sort of what's going on here with this chart and with the next chart, and in fact with all the charts above it, is the tremendous energy, psychological energy that you bring to this stuff. I think it's very hard to understand and to appreciate just how much energy it takes to shuffle all these cards. And you appear to have done it for a long time and are still doing it. And at least to my mind, it's a marvel. You do it with a great deal of humor and a great deal of optimism, but it wouldn't be worth anything if it weren't engaging with gaps and with the sort of discrepancies that most people don't like to think about. So you're kind of dancing over the riddles of human nature and attempting to unriddle them to some extent. And I just, I find it difficult to really appreciate in terms of imagining doing it myself. I think I bring a certain psychological energy to other questions and to other respects of unriddling. But my experience in that regard, I don't think is a very good standard, if you will, to what you're doing in all of these charts, which are only a tiny fraction of the shuffling of the mental deck that you're doing in other respects as well. So that said, I come to the bottom of the formula chart, and we have the flat line there on the extreme left column, and then on the right we have the presidential U. And we have Bob Rule.
And lockdown Bob Rule.
Yeah, well, all of the extreme HCE column is lockdowns of various sorts, right?
Yes.
Every one of them.
Yeah.
So the way that I understand this may or may not be the way that you intended. And so what I'm going to describe can be taken as a question. And that is that the all of the presidents with their masks and with their chronological and psychological lags to what's going on are human beings. And as human beings, they have something of a grasp of what's going on and can even be taken to symbolize it, but there's a vast gulf between their human nature, maybe that's the chemical body, and their and the demands of the overall situation. So when we have this lockdown Bob Rule apparently extending to 2020, My understanding would be that by continuing the McLuhan interrogation, you might say, that you have the necessary tool combined with the energy that I was speaking about previously to deal with the overall situation. But at the same time, you're a human individual with all of the inherent discrepancies between being a human individual and this vast riddle that requires unriddling. And so my understanding of where we're going from the formula chart to the tiny note chart is that the flat line, what has happened to the ground column, the flat line represents both a disintegration of previous answers and previous attempts at unriddling, and the clue that you are going to attempt to use in your further unriddling in the tiny note chart.
Yes.
So how does that fit with your own meanings?
That's very good. Thank you. I want to thank you for what you said, but I consider your work requires a lot of energy, which I'm not inclined to do. Your kind of etymological, going back and detailing all these things, I think that stuff, but I talk it rather than write it out. But what I like is that you have found the gold all over the place that I found. So it's a delight to read your columns, your topics, because you're the only person who's ever pointed out these quotes that I know about and thought about that I can think about. And so I guess I'm more oral in taking this encyclopedic corpus by McLuhan, and you're more literate or writing. You write it out. But we understand each other really well from our different biases. So I appreciate what you said, but feelings mutual in a sense. I admire what you have done in your inventory. And probably at the beginning, your inventory is more valuable than mine, because people got to find out what McLuhan said, which you present. And then they can see, they have a way to understand what I develop from, which is from all the stuff you point out. So about the flat line. So you're asking about how the tiny note chart comes out of the formula chart?
No, maybe less than that. I'm just asking if my understanding, especially of the last horizontal row of the chart, if my understanding of that is the proper introduction to where you're going to go with your comments on the tiny note chart.
Yes, but we may have in the previous recording, which unfortunately got cut off, we may have talked about holopathic cliche probes and satellite and laser beam a little bit, right? Did we do anything on that?
Perhaps not enough.
Yeah.
Trying to, if I understand the last row, I kind of skip over those two, and maybe that's inappropriate.
No, they have to be understood. You heard about, on the news today, a video game shop called Game Shop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and there was like an Occupy Wall Street phenomenon coming out of Reddit that raised the stock of Game Shop as it was getting ready to implode. and upset the designs of billionaires, big companies.
Correct.
Which
yep.
the popular sentiment in people loves for the big guys to get beat up like that. But in people talking about it, they kept using the word meme. And Wall Street is memeing stocks and this and that, memeing. It was a verb. And I think I spell this out in the book that you had 30 years ago the words virtual reality, what was another one? There was a couple of words about the new internet culture, the virtual situation. But I called it Android meme. I made the boast in my book a few months ago that my word became what people chose to describe what was going on. The word meme. They don't say virtualizing stocks or that. They go memeing this, memeing that. So the millennials and younger, they use this word meme. And that's what I meant by homeopathic cliche probes. I don't know how much I was thinking about meme when I made the chart, but within a couple of years, by 97, I came up with Android meme. And that's a robotic, automatic process where the machines take over the situation. But it's a software memeing that's going on, and people spend their lives keeping up with the memes or dropping off. So I realized my meaning for homeopathic cliche probes, what was a reductionist process of living in the global hologram or the global theater and people engaging news stories or idea trends or fads or stars or art forms that rapidly moved around or inside our circuitry and got smaller and smaller and more ransacking old culture, like in the big effects movies, the Superman movies and that, taking cliches and probing them, using them as probes, which is exactly what McLuhan spelled out would happen from cliche to archetype. So homeopathic cliche probes is tinier and faster memes is what it's referring to. And it's interacting with the hardware of the satellite, laser beam, and on the ground fiber optics. So that's the hardware, but the content is this turnover of memes. And I don't know when kids started talking about memes, maybe 5 years ago. Do you have an idea about that?
No.
But you know it's recently, right? Within the last five years.
Yeah. So, but the phrase itself came from the 70s, right?
Yeah, in 1976, Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene. He invented the term and the definition. So why did these kids pick up on that? But this is the process McLuhan talked about. The collective consciousness of people engaging media seem to agree on an effect that's happening. And so a word that shows up has the perfect pitch, and people use it. So back in the mid-60s, I remember oddballs would say, well, I'm going to find out where it's at, you know. They'd use this phrase, where it's at. But within 5 years, respectable postal clerks or lawyers were talking about finding out where it's at, right? The phrase resonated with what people were perceiving consciously or half-consciously. And McLuhan picked up on this and said our consciousness, would more and more as we went through the 70s, would be constantly probing and finding out where it's at. McLuhan understood the archetypal process in that cliche phrase. You agree with me?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I'm confused about the term cliche probe. Because at least on one level, when people are picking up on these cliches, they're doing anything but probing.
That's right.
Right? So you could say that probing occurs on a whole series of levels, right? On one level, people's minds are sort of automatically searching for the proper word.
Yes.
Right, but they're unconscious that they're probing in that sense. It's just something that sort of happens in a background mode, and all of a sudden they find themselves talking in a certain way. Right?
Now,
and then
I want to just interject there.
Yeah.
McLuhan uses the phrase cliche probe in From Cliche to Archetype, 1970. I see the environment ransacks all through the book From Cliche to Archetype. He refers to Yeats's poem, The Circus Animal's Desertion, about how the poet lays down and sort of is among the garbage and refuse of
the and the rag and bone shop.
Right. And then he finds from those cliches a new, well, archetype, McLuhan says, or he makes an effect in a new work, which is new and surprising, which has or retrieves archetypal resonances. So the environment, the Android meme, took over the creative process, and it was taking cliche probes or cliches, ransacking, and McLuhan says at the end of Take Today that the Global Theater uses everything for its repertoire, right? It's got the whole past.
Yeah, right. Sure.
And that becomes a mental tourism, but also a global tourism. That was one of the major businesses since the 80s. People going around engaging archetypal environments, but they would be always mixed up by the next generation and altered and be used in a new way. So the Android meme, and people participating in it, they are probing with garbage, with cliches. And they don't recognize it as a probing process. But that's what's happening.
Right.
At least the Android meme does that back to us.
Right. So let's just say that what Yeats saw as the poetic function, I think you are saying, got taken over, perhaps in an unconscious way, by the human collective.
And their media,
okay.
Yeah.
So let me just back up for a minute here. Isn't this exactly how language functions?
Yes.
And how McLuhan always talked about language? Language itself is constantly changing. People have to learn how to engage it in new ways. And people can contribute themselves to how language changes. So to me, what we're talking about here is language prior to Yeats, let's say, always had a certain self-steering, cybernetic reality that captured everything that could possibly be said or experienced, only some of which possibilities were actually realized in language. So when you come up to people like Yeats, then you have the poetic assumption of this task, right? There's a realization of what language is and of the need for poets to engage themselves with that language process. And maybe Finnegan's Wake represents sort of the end station of that need or that demand.
Yep.
And so then what I'm a little bit confused about is that what you call the Android meme sort of takeover of that process seems to me to either be a renaming of that process, but it's the same process, or you're saying that the renaming actually points out something new that's happened to that process.
Yeah, I would take the new angle. You know, McLuhan's final insight, he talked about in the late 70s, he repeated all over the place in his letters, and I don't know if he might say it in City's Classroom. He he said he realized, wow, all technologies are words. And he would italicize words. And that's what I'm getting at, that the environments are linguistic. They're not words, but they're doing that cliche archetype word process you just outlined. But it's being done by something that requires a perceptual updating, or you're going to be alienated by it. You're going to think it's something new or external or strange or maybe even totalitarian. You have to look at this new snow and see the 50 kinds in a new way. So the new demand might be the newness, or is the environment new? And it requires your old habits to be refreshed because you're dealing with something new. So maybe it's hard to tell, it's ambivalent, about what is new, the new demands on the traditional tools, or the environment is completely new. Now, to me, it seems completely new. What people live is ridiculous. You remember previous societies, the fact that people walk along looking at their cell phone all day long, this is ridiculous, right? I mean, I can understand that the cell phone is new nature and way more engrossing than our physical nature or what's around us. You have endless synaptic imagery triggering delight or shock, endlessly engaged. But it seems to be very irresponsible to be carried away like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looks
to me
like,
it seems like the new gum.
Yes.
Right? In the 1950s, everybody's chewing gum. And by
and smoking.
Chewing gum, yeah. And so in both of those, you're showing that the thing that's going on with you is more important than what's going on the outside.
Yes.
You're showing that you're self-involved and that you don't give a shit, actually, right? You don't give a shit about your own teeth. You don't give a shit about your own lungs. And you especially don't give a shit about anybody that may be looking at you, right?
Right.
And in order to express those things, you have to express the opposite. Right? You wouldn't be chewing gum the way you are. You wouldn't be smoking the way you are unless you were ultra uptight about people
yep.
looking at you. Right?
That's right.
And the same thing's going on with these goddamn phones.
Yes.
Right? It's my world is what people are saying. But of course, what's on the phone is not their world. And what's going on around them that they're consciously ignoring is the world.
Right. They are they're saying this mental tactile sensory engagement with the phone and all its contents is way more fun than anything you humans could come up with.
Absolutely. Or that they themselves as humans.
Yes,
right?
That they would come up with. That's right. And, you know, there were postmodern terms. I talked about the commodification of reality and of art,
right.
And some other cliches I can't remember right now, but you'd see it riddled in the books. Croker was
a
good replay of a lot of these terms, but he had a nice spin on it. He'd add something to it. But you'd find out what the jargon was in the postmodern authors that were prominent in the 80s and 90s from reading him. Recombinant commodity was another one. Android processor. But go ahead.
What he would point out, not in these words, but what he would point out and what McLuhan had already pointed out is that when people make this implied statement that what is going on here is much more important than what's going on in the world or in my own mind or whatever, what they're doing is they're repeating something that's been advertised or propagandized to them, right? So they the trick is, as the folks around 1950 in the Frankfurt School were already pointing out, the trick is to get people to internalize what is an objective commercial message.
Yeah.
Right? So
yes.
They believe they're doing something that's personal and important to them, but it's nothing other than them contributing their energy and money to Apple or Facebook or whatever.
Right. But there is the fact the user is the content, there is a liberation. You know, Orwell and Huxley got it wrong. They didn't get it. McLuhan got it. He said, this is amazing participation mystique. This is not, people are not being brainwashed. They're not being that. It doesn't matter what the content was, he used to say on the radio. It's sharing the space, and you Canadians do it all the time, right? They get up and they listen to CBC Morning, whoever that person was, Zosky or somebody. And it didn't matter who Zosky had on. It was the fact they're all sharing this electric discarnate space, just like in America would be Good Morning America, one of those shows. And so the messages of the culture, if there was propagandistic purposes like ads on Good Morning America, they don't work. They're irrelevant to the large part of people's experience. But then when they fall back and get lazy, you could say into the chemical body, then that might be subject to what they saw and want to go get that car or something. But most of their experience, you know, by the 60s, is sharing electric space. And this shocked,
sure, but,
this shocked
yeah.
the cult, the Gutenberg culture controllers, the conductors, the symphony players, all the old opera. They didn't understand that people couldn't get involved in that stuff anymore. They were involved in a new electric space, which had a lot of teenage content.
Right. But the thing that needs to be remembered, even for the Frankfurt School, is that pointing out the commercialization of things is not the end point. The end point, also in McLuhan, is to show that the commercialization is itself not important. What is important is that the world is going down a shithole and there is an inability to deal with that.
Yes.
Where the commercialization is one aspect of that inability.
And two things. You can see in the incredible corrupt world we're in old moral ethical terms, that McLuhan's concern and said, we better turn this off for a minute to get our bearings. And we're doomed. And so we have doomed ourselves. So he was right in that point. The other thing is the way they describe millennials and younger people like Zoomers, the way they are, how they're very uninvolved in social realities. They aren't even concerned about sex, apparently. And many of the Zoomers want to remain virgins and be devoted to, pure marriage. And that's just one part of it. I understand they're not interested in football, all kinds of things.
Right.
They just want to be stimulated. And this is where my tiny note chart in the Dobbs quadrant, the main characteristic is ecstasy. Now, I was aware of Baudrillard's important book in 87, The Ecstasy of Communication. So I was probably thinking of that, plus the drug effect, the ecstatic effect of television, cable TV, then the Internet 1.0, then 2.0, then social media. People are in a throes of eating lotus or something, lotus eaters kind of thing, in the engagement with the Android meme and its contents. That's the amazing situation and the ecstatic situation people are in. So all the older ecstasies don't matter as much.
Right. When you use ecstasy there, isn't that a variant or a synonym for lockdown?
Yes.
In the formula chart?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, okay.
The ecstatic paralysis.
Yeah.
Yes, the lockdown
everything. The spider's net.
Yes. And, you know, people like to say Postum's amusing ourselves to death. That's not violent enough, that phrase, you know, amusing ourselves as if, no, we have been abducted ourselves to death, possessed,
yeah,
way beyond being amused. People aren't amused. They have to be in the space, which they think is a shared space. It is not perceptually.
So, just back up there. That seems to me to be an interesting thing you just said. I think you said people aren't amused, but they need to be in the space.
Yes. And they think it's shared, but everybody's hallucinating. Their user's content is dominating. They're hyper-subjective. That's another postmodern word. Hyper-subjectivity is going on. In terms of community matching, no sharing. But they are engaging in a space, and everybody's in that digital node. So that's being shared, the raw ecstasy of it. But the content can be expendable. It's not important, the content.
Right. And so the billiard balls that are bouncing off each other in this description you just made.
Yes.
Those billiard balls are the memes.
Yes. Yeah. And the people are cyborgian. They're attached to the memes. They're involved in it. They're putting meaning in the meme. They're preferring it. Of course, that's only a short time. You know, 6 weeks or something. Then there's another meme. So take the billiard ball of literate consciousness, and it's still there. It might even be even more reinforced by the autonomous floating over the planet discarnate satellite experience that people are doing, the cybernauts. But there's also an implosion and melting of things. So it's you can see in Finnegan's Wake, Joyce describing the disappearance of community and individual and all kinds of disappearances while it's one person dreaming or listening at media in a tavern. You can see the mixture. You can't use words to say it to cover the whole thing, to the whole experience. That's
right.
The new part is that people are experiencing a non-communicative, traditional chemical body communicative space.
But it's not as if human beings ever lacked gaps, right? The very first word that was ever spoken by humans had to cross a gap between the two of them, a gap of space.
Yeah.
But not only a gap of space, a gap between what was a grunt and now was a word. Or
a verbum.
The two individuals. Sorry?
Verbum. Ever seen McLuhan's tetrad on verbum?
Sure.
Right. It's a grunt.
Yeah.
It's the stage before you get to word or some kind of.
That's right. So
yeah.
But the point is that from the very beginning, human beings are characterized by gaps, right? And these gaps we've talked about in the past, there's a gap between the particular possibility of human being that you're living and the all of the possibilities of human being that you could be living, which is like a language uses certain sounds in certain ways, and each one of those sounds and each one of those ways has a vertical a drop, you could say, underneath it that represents particular decisions, but not decisions that were made by any individual person, right? So the sound for Q, let's say, is probably not present in the Hawaiian language, right? Now, they could have had the sound Q, but somebody made the decision the decision was made in the language process not to have that sound, right? So
yes.
The Hawaiian language, I believe, only has something like, I don't know, 10 or 12 sounds, right? It's the Polynesian languages are distinguished by their very restricted sound range, which means that the languages have developed in distinctive ways that they can express everything they need to express, but they do so with a very limited sound vocabulary, you'd say, right?
Yep.
So all I'm trying to say here is that languages develop, or when human possibilities are developed into an individual, there's a whole series of gaps that are implied below those things, right? And one of the purposes, I would say, of Finnegan's Wake is to exploit the omnipresence of these gaps, these horizontal and vertical gaps that are kind of the semantic and somatic environment of every human at every moment.
Yeah, now, right? Yes. Now, the description of the takeover by the smartphone, a wise person could see that speech did that to early humans. Speech was this overpowering environment.
Absolutely. That's where I was going. I was going to ask you if the gaps that are inherent in human nature are in some way engaged in a new way in your sort of vision of what's going on.
I would say in the gaps are the later technologies.
Sure. Okay, good. Yeah, the electric technology for McLuhan makes possible an understanding of media for the first time, because all media was based on gaps, but electricity is a conscious foundation in a gap.
That's right. So he said the shaman, the perceptive person, or human, always saw the ground rules of the culture. They saw the hyper-involvement in whatever media they were developed at. So the shaman could see through the tricks of language, or the enveloping of language. And then early writing, who was good at that could see through it, because imagination was, as McLuhan defined it, was that faculty not embedded in the sensory environment, not embedded in its extensions. You see, he's not in it. He or she is not in. Somehow they can see through the effects. And then it's very hard for them to communicate that to people who don't see it. But then they get aberrated psychic effects from that, so they appear to have second sight or something. You know, other odd anomalies comes out of the shaman. Even their creative works, painting and poetry, is an odd production that comes out of their inability to get people to see what they see. And so in the gaps is all other possibilities of human experience. So that's what I mean. It contains, the gaps contain all media. And that's what you see in Finnegan's Wake. He presents all kinds of media from all through history on each page, often symbolized by languages. So he's showing the whole constantly, but making a little particular angle on it. About that particular pitch, and that's represented by the 10 thunders and the changes they represent, or the context. So once we have all these gaps expressed, we're still subject to the laws of media, but it can lead to our extinction. I don't think speech could lead to our extinction. You know, speech as an environment, a new environment, taking over people. It led to a lot of violence. And maybe, a couple of tribes were wiped out. But to have the whole chemical body reality, that people think is reality, tossed off as not relevant, which is where we're at now, is a whole new thing. It was replay of all former Armageddons or apocalypses. So this is the curious, ambivalent situation, the same anew. That's a phrase in Finnegan's Wake. I think it's spelled S-E-I-M. Anew, the same anew, A-N-E-W. And that's what I'm getting at. and everybody else got to that. If they got a pretty comprehensive art form going, they could see. And McLuhan has on page 11 of Take Today, you know, the accidents of new media environments happen, but man is still the content. So there's something that stays while the clothes change. And that's,
yeah.
You know, I say that. That's a simple, it sort of sounds like a pretty good statement, but it's nothing compared to what's going on in our environment today.
Yeah, but am I right that the environment has a kind of ambivalence to it? So Nietzsche in 1888, if that's the right year, says that with the true world, we have also abolished the apparent one.
Yes.
And now here we are 150 years later, more or less. What Nietzsche was talking about is now the lived reality, right? And so you could say that it's the fate of the collective to live the ecstasy and the depression of what has been foreseen by somebody like Nietzsche, but it requires that collective agony, that collective drama for the problem posed by Nietzsche to be solved. So we're
now. It needs a collectivity? You're saying the drama needs to be collectivized?
Yes.
And that's our global Esperanto, we were saying last week. That's what's communicated. Collective consciousness.
I wonder if I don't know if that we may be talking about two slightly different things there.
I would include both. You emphasize one, and then I might emphasize the other. But I'm including yours when I add mine.
Okay, but what are the two that you're talking about besides you and me?
Well, when I see a problem that somebody's going through, I have to decide whether to get involved and assist. And both responses, getting involved or not, are adequate. That's the paradox. You know, sometimes it's not good to interfere and get involved. So right now, there are all kinds of voters for Trump supporters, 74 million is the iconic figure they toss around, who are trying to figure out whether to do something about what they think is an abomination, which is the Biden takeover, right? And who's to say whether you get involved or not if the public becomes indifferent and accepts Biden or others try to blow him up? It's hard to judge which action is correct. Because if we are in real trouble, which you talk about occasionally, something should be done and always was done. Might be a war, but it gets to some resolution after a while. So I mean both all the time. And so yoga, McLuhan said in Forbes magazine in 1966, self-entertainment is the new yoga. I consider my interaction with people and environments or technologies as a yoga thing. And I mean by yoga a kind of a discipline. I don't do sitting on a mat and put my hands on my kneecaps and get into this meditative posture. I see a lot of it on the beach. People are gazing into the sun and that. I consider my walking along observing people and looking at their enrapture in the cell phone and noticing it, being aware of it, as my yoga. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. I think what I was trying to ask about, though, was something slightly different, and that is that when we speak of the self-absorption of people in their phones and see it as, in many respects, an empty gesture, right? An empty mind, empty of external world, looking at a empty apparatus with empty junk going on there. That replay of what was already seen in the 19th century by Nietzsche and others,
right.
That replay may be the only way that the world actually can digest something like that 19th century insight.
Well, what did you say? The replay is the only way we can digest it. Is that what you said?
Yeah. I'm saying, well, maybe it's the only way, right? So when Nietzsche foresees the end of the apparent world, one thing he could be seen as saying is that we're going to blow up the whole goddamn thing, and that's the end of the apparent world, right? Or he could be saying, this is the problem, the riddle that needs to be solved. Right, we need
yes.
to go through the vanishing point in order to come up with, you know, a sustainable world.
Yep,
a sustainable notion of human being, if you will. So, if we're going to live through in many different takings of the word through. If we're going to live through to a sustainable world and to sustainable human relationships and stuff, then we have to ask, what is the process through which that happens? And one answer to that might be that the collective, in its numbness, in its ignorance of what it's actually doing, needs to assume that problem as a kind of world digestive process.
A political act, you mean?
Not as something that's completely unconscious, but it's living out what language has always done, right? Language has always taken whatever modifications were thrown at it and digested it and adopted it and gone on as language. And what Joyce is doing in Finnegan's Wake, one of the things he's doing is he's saying, well, human beings aren't in charge of these processes. These processes go on as if dreamt or as if seen in a trance. And yet, these processes are what the individual and the individual's family are.
So you're saying the solution is there in the digestive process?
Well, really, I was asking if that's what you had in mind.
Half of me. Or maybe one quarter of me does. Oh, no. You know that, I think
that's
it's Pope, Alexander Pope's the essay, he wrote the essay on man or of man, the essay on man.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think that ends with whatever is right. You remember that, if that is the last line?
Well, I remember you mentioning it in the past.
Yeah, I've thought about it for uh-huh. you know a long time because uh-huh. they, you know, every argument possible in the world, it can be shone on that. Is it satirical? Is it actually a profound piece? You know, like the media ecology that McLuhan said we require, he actually saw it happening in the updates of language, the updating of words in the media processes.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when the printing press came in, you know, stepped up the eye, there needed to be some balance in the ear, so opera got made. Human solved it. You know, we're solving things, but we also have anxiety. The stages of apprehension, meaning understanding, are the stages of getting more and more nervous, right? both
right,
are there.
Sure. There's always the two faces.
Yeah.
The Janus phenomenon.
Yeah, the tragedy and the comedy. And I think people instinctively know that, but they have different ways of talking, and you have to talk a certain way in a certain group. You can't talk another way, and that's just talking. That's a large part of our history. But now, what kind of YouTube do you make? That's your talking. What they say, the kids are very obsessive about their face when they get on Instagram or how they look. You know, this endless preoccupation of getting it right, according to your interpretation of what the tone or pitch of the environment you're, the bubble you're trying to be relevant in, you have to know what it is. So there's so many different, what McLuhan would call maybe subcultures, genres of every kind of human media and communication that nobody can keep up with the yoga or the discipline of being correct. So there's a lot of misunderstanding, which began with 1.0, you know, emailing and communicating digitally caused a lot of violence in people's relationships. That didn't stop them. They keep going in there. They might have to move to another form or another place because they've got kicked out. But the now, think of a little village, and people are living, and McLuhan used to point out that village had a lot of tensions and, you know, suppressed violence. So the women meet at the well, and they're talking, and they got their alliances and their jealousies and all this crap's going on. Tension of consciousness, the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions. It's always happening. I call that simply merging and blocking. We now do it with huge environments, which also shrunk. And right now, when I'm on the radio, there's a chat line, and people are commenting, insulting, all kinds of crazy reactions to what I'm saying, but I'm talking to people who are speaking, who are there on the phone, and I got to pay attention to them. I can't respond to all this commentary that's going on the chat line, you know? And so it's an absurd situation. A lot of communication going on, and you only get to respond to a little tiny part. And I don't know who these people are, a lot of them. They change their names, or they're different people every week, and they make... If I go back and later review their comments, very good stuff. I'd love to have talked about it. But what's amazing to me is that these people come in, post it, and they don't care if I get to it. You know, there's an incredible difference going on, as well as super involvement. So all directions are happening now, in front of us, or hearing. You know, in a simpler village, one could make the case that a lot's going on because, you know, I remember the famous story of this tribe. Everybody in the morning had to tell what they dreamt. They had to process their dreams, discuss them before the day unfolded. You ever heard of that anthropological story?
No, I haven't, but it makes a certain amount of sense, sure.
Yeah, like humans are always balancing what their interaction. In the older days, you know, around speech and gesture. But now you got corporations doing press conferences all through the day, and they think they have to do that, and they're supposed to go to somebody out there that's going to respond and appreciate the press conference. It's so absurd the amount of communication that's going on, and then you find out that, you know, the National Security Agency or something can process and record every phone call, every email. It's all there. You know, if somebody needs it. And so everybody is waiting for someone to make a false move. And that's what happens on Twitter. You make the wrong statement in the wrong place, you get flamed and you're fired. You know what I mean? So if awareness, as Charles Manson said, it was paranoia, we are at the highest decibels, that's McLuhan's word, of awareness and paranoia. Everybody. As they get more involved, what a crazy, it's like we're engaged in an ESP, and ESP is a really violent environment. Okay, so that's the present, those tensions. And maybe people always had those tensions, and you have that great sentence, a dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions. And I think that's such a great statement of the interactions of our multiple mirrors and senses. And McLuhan says, if you get it right, you got the golden section, which some kind of balance or symmetry or perfection appears. May not last long. Okay, so I'm not. Try to say your question again. I don't know if I'm answering it. I'd like to hear you attempt to say the question properly. Let's have you say it better. What is it, the question you're directing at me?
Well, I mean, originally I was talking about your formula chart and whether my understanding of the formula chart was a proper or satisfactory introduction to your tiny note chart. And then we got off from there talking about memes. And
which was my attempt to answer it. So what was your initial, can you remember partly at least what you said that you thought the formula chart was doing?
Yes, all right. Before I do that, though, I'll just mention that my understanding of the last row, horizontal row of the formula chart, didn't really get into holeopathic cliche probes and the satellite and laser beam
interaction,
right? And so then a lot of what we just talked about for almost an hour was your understanding of holeopathic cliche probes and satellite and laser beams. And then from that, we got into whether or not the participation in memes could be understood as a cliche probe or only as cliche.
Yes.
Right? And so then the whole question came up, well, the background question at any rate came up, what is a probe? And then we discussed the fact that probes can be understood on many different levels.
Yeah.
And that probes are always going on, whether we know it or not.
Yeah.
And so then the question came up, at least in background mode of whether or not a certain kind of probing is going on now that might be
different.
Slash critical.
Yes.
Right. That we've because of our technology and because of the homogenization of the world, the melting, that we've come to a point where either we solve or find as solved certain problems, or we're going to blow ourselves out of existence.
And elections are nowhere near the appropriate response to that dilemma.
No, of course not.
Of course not. Everybody knows that. But they spend a whole 2 years focusing on it. It's a ridiculous red herring situation. But then McLuhan said we're distracted from distraction by distraction. Being distracted helps the ecology balance.
Well, that's a observation that belongs in the question of what is a probe.
Yeah.
Right? If people are actually probing in a certain way in their distractions, then a different kind of understanding of what is going on in human society is necessary.
Yep.
Actually, that brings me back to another point I wanted to make about the formula chart. I'll just make it here in brackets, although you may want to run with it. And that is that aside from the energy of thought that you bring to these charts, the formula chart is illustrative of how one of the chief problems that you're shuffling all the time is the question of time.
Yeah.
right? And that's because what the chart sets out is that there are causes that sort of run before themselves. There's a shadow before the
event. Yeah, the event.
And so the effect shows itself before the cause, and then when the cause finally does arrive, then it shows itself as the effect of the effect that is now the cause.
Yeah, they merge.
And so
which I have up top, I have that causes merging with effects, and effects.
Yeah.
Preceding causes, you know, it's there.
Correct. And what happens with this view of history is that you have a kind of maelstrom effect where the attempt is being made by this shuffling of the cards of thought. The attempt is being made in your brain to understand the new way of looking at time and looking at history.
Yeah.
And that is that because the Gutenberg Galaxy is still so powerful in us, we tend to think that if we're going to understand a story, then we have to understand it in sequence. And we have to understand it in definable bits in that sequence. And of course, all of this talk of sequence and definable bits and time's arrow is what Gutenberg Galaxy is.
Yes.
And if we're going to think beyond it, in where both the danger and possible saving lies, then what we have to be able to do is think not in sequence, not in sequential bits, but in something like the thinking that's going on in your chart here.
Yes, where, the tiny note is to move it out of the sequence of the formula chart.
Gotcha. Right. So that's, I mean, and in that sense, I can see the tiny note chart as a kind of effusion, right? I mean, the only impression
D-I?
I have...
D-I? Diffusion? D-I?
No, effusion.
Okay, yeah.
Flowering.
Yes.
Right? It's I understand almost nothing of the tiny note chart, except that practically everything... that has ever occurred in the history of the world is either there or implied there.
That's right.
Right?
So, I charted. I made Finnegan's Wake into a chart. Herculean act.
Okay, so let's just then if all of Finnegan's Wake is there, if you're attempting to clean out the stables by redirecting a river like Hercules. Let's just go back to my question from the final line of the chart.
Yes.
Right? You're the presidential mask and lag is you.
Yes.
Right? When you say me, that's Bob, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And then that goes on to lockdown Bob rule. And what I was saying is that what I find interesting there is to consider you as an individual person, a chemical body person.
Yes.
Right? So our sense of all of this stuff that's going on with the homeopathic cliche probes and their interaction with the satellite and laser beam environment is something that is absolutely huge, but our only access to it is in individual fleshly people.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And so you have what I see as coming out of this bottom line is you have the line that expresses the death of the whole chart on the bottom extreme left.
Yeah, what is that? That's the flat line.
The flat line, yeah.
Yeah.
Good, exactly. So the flat line represents both the end of something and the potential new something.
Yep.
Right? And
yep.
The that needs to be born out of individual chemical bodies with all of their limitations and stuff, but somehow with the ability to think this stuff.
Yes.
Right? Which I guess is going to get expressed in the next chart.
Yes.
But it just seems to me that if somebody were looking at the formula chart, they would have to realize that this sort of what might on the one hand be seen as a exaltation or inflation, you know, Bob as the president and Bob as the lockdown rule,
yeah,
right? It has to be understood that, number one, this is a chemical body person and not some sort of, Weltgeist, world spirit enveloping the times or something, number one. And number two, the lockdown Bob rule did not actually rule anything. Everything was chaotic and got out of hand and stuff, right? And so we need to, if we go on to the tiny note chart from here, we have to understand all of these sort of conflicts.
Yes.
Between end and beginning, between
in the
great
gap.
Insight and, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I think Alan Watts, he wrote once, total bang equals total void. I think of that right now, occurs to me. So let me just talk a bit about this. As I look at it and hear you talking about it, this is amazingly prophetic. This is 1995. This is, the internet has just started, which inflates people in a different way than Web 2.0 does. Web 2.0 does make everybody a god techne-wise, you know, to use a modern term, techne, technically. And I like Croker's idea to express the dire situation of the flatline. Croker says our genes left our bodies and leaped into the virtual technologies. Our genes abandoned us. I mean, this, you know, he's reaching. He's trying to figure out how to express how dire it is, how flatlined we are. So the flat line happened in 1945, then with television, then with the satellite. I'm showing the ratios or phases of flatlining. And then we become completely conscious of it somewhere recently. And we're witnessing memes fighting the satellite communication structure that's happening, which we don't even think of satellites now. It's just, it's all over the place, and it's a huge surveillance thing that's going on. So everybody becomes a me. So this can be a Trump Leo. The me isn't necessarily Bob, right? It's just you.
Yeah.
Anybody is flated by Web 2.0. I mean, they can broadcast, do all kinds of things.
Yeah. That's why I asked if it was Bob or not.
It is, but not just Bob.
No, I understand. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There is no just.
That's right. And so lockdown can mean that I'm in jail. You know, I was ruling. And then they stopped it. They locked it down. They put Bob away. There's that way. Or it can mean that Bob locked down everybody. And rule... That can be what? I don't know how one would rule today. But I'm thinking as I look at this, this is exactly what Trump did. The me of Trump took over, and he locked everybody down. And he just monitored media. The rumors are that he'd watch TV all night and watch the media talk about him, and then he'd say something outrageous or do something the next day. And he freed up the economy because he allowed black money to come in without being taxed. So that caused all kinds of new circulation. He did all kinds of crazy things. All the time being erasable or being erased. And everybody just said, we got to put up with this idiot for 4 years, then we'll get rid of him. You know what I mean? I see, to me, that I was predicting the Trump phenomenon, the narcissism of Trump, or whatever people thought was this crazy guy who was just into it for himself. He appeared to be, right? And he didn't have to have normal chemical body wisdom or communication skills. He actually, the more I was watching somebody, Frank Luntz, the pollster, saying the shock was that every mistake Trump made in the old terms, in the human terms, enhanced his image.
Yeah.
And so the newspapers, New York Times, they didn't know what to do with this. This is like, what, they're going around and expose the next problem with him, the next evil thing he did, and you're just going to inflate him. I mean, it must have been crazy in the New York Times office trying to figure out how to deal with this, and it's through the last 4 years. I heard a couple of interviews with them. Every now and then they'd go in like doctors to check the pulse of the New York Times, and they'd complain about the whole situation or how bad it was and how to even keep up. And the guy is not stable. He doesn't say the same thing. He changes it. It was a wonderful performance by Trump and his multiple bodies. If you wanted to, screw the anarchistic impulse in art, and the famous one is Stravinsky, 1913, put on his whatever the Rite of Spring, whatever it was, and there was a riot because the sound is so different, right? So
yeah, yeah.
The Dionysian.
Major,
what?
Major composers that were at the concert got up in the middle and ceremoniously walked out.
Yeah, and so this becomes a great artwork, but it disrupts, deregulement des senses, that quote McLuhan used.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so
a quotation from Rambeau or somebody like that.
Yeah, or Lautremont, or might have been some other guy, Rene somebody. Who's the guy that they talked about? It might have been Lautremont. No, he was too early. There was another guy in the 20s that they occasionally quoted that people didn't know so well. But anyways, now I'm thinking that is Artaud or Rambeau. You might be right. The Regulament des Sens might be Rambeau. Okay, so I see Trump, and I wrote about it in the spring of his first of his term. I said, this guy is doing the causative method of art, not the ethical cathartic method, and it is an incredible hijacking, which you'll see in my tiny note chart. That's Rumpelstiltskin. He did a Rumpelstiltskin on everybody, and but many people were doing that in their Web 2.0 lives, interrupting, trolling, jumping into conversations, hijacking them, becoming known for it. You know what I mean? He really did express what people were doing in the ecstasy of communication.
Yeah.
So, and that's part of the point here. Each president, like a perfect word, has perfect pitch for the tone of the time, of the milieu or the media mix. Okay, so you have this death and rebirth or flatlining and what could be seen as not negative, not a flatlining. All possibilities are there in that blank. And so that's some of the meanings I was trying to get at. And I think it was accurate. We saw the me, Tom Wolfe, 1970s, that was the me decade. But we never saw a me in politics. Clinton began it. He was considered a narcissist. George Bush was a me. He refused to read the newspapers. And these are the public bullshit about these people, right? We don't know what they did, but they create mythologies, right? That that George Bush Jr. didn't read the newspapers, didn't care, couldn't read almost. So each one, so then Obama was narcissistic because he was such a big collective hope and he didn't do anything that people expected. He's too busy doing something else for himself. And then Trump, you know, caps it off with the ultimate me. So, and Biden's so much a me, he doesn't even show up. Okay, there's a lot to say about what we say about Biden, but I like my opening line is Trump created involvement like a stutterer by not finishing his sentences. Well, Biden squared Trump, went further, and he didn't finish his syllables. It's created great involvement. So involved were people in it that he didn't have to campaign. So that's a flat line image.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so I think I've laid it out and got close to answering your question somehow. And let's go to the sacred tiny note chart, which is what
Okay, good.
Everybody knows about the tiny note chart. They don't know about the formula chart. The tiny note chart's the one I put out there. It even got by 96 it got printed in a punk pop culture magazine called Flipside, which was very popular among 18-year-olds. There were a lot of people writing in it about their local scenes for Minnesota or someplace, some obscure place, and they'd make a big deal out of it. This was during the zine, but it was a bigger, thicker zine in the 90s, and, you know, it got circulated all over the major stores. And eventually, some of these crazy columnists, and they were very much younger than me, one guy started complaining about me. He said, we are not a real magazine if we let Bob Dobbs be in here. Which was hilarious. And nobody cared. Nobody listened to his complaint. The editors wanted me in there, so I just carried on. But it was funny seeing generational conflict happening, you know. Somehow, my chart, it did not appeal to the young kids or even having a chart in there. Okay.
At some point, I believe in Abe Books or maybe in Amazon or something, I saw that somebody was selling either a complete set or nearly a complete set of that magazine, and so I bought it.
What? You got all the flip sides?
I think so.
Wow.
I haven't thought about this for 10 or 15 years or maybe even longer. But I believe somewhere, maybe in the garage or something, I have these things. And
why did you buy them? Am I responsible for that act?
Yeah. Well, I knew that you'd been in the magazine and that basically they were selling the complete set for $11 or something. And so I thought, what the hell? And I just bought it.
Well, you may have more than me. I've got all of them since I was in it, and they're out in the garage. We should go look at them together at some point.
All right. We'll take that as a task for the future.
Yes.
I don't even know if I could find them.
Right, but that's incredible. That's pretty good detective work on me, but let's go find out where Bob was. I take that as a great compliment.
Yeah, you're
tracking me down. Well, I think it was important what I did in that place in a flat line situation. Remember, the flat line is 1990 to 2020, 30-year flat line.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me explain the first vision, the first structure, which I didn't complete. We got cut off. So we're in New York City, and the introduction of how we got to New York is at the end of the last recording, so they can hear that.
No. We got cut off just where the people in New York contact you and your wife in Toronto.
Yes.
And ask if you're interested in a certain machine. And then They come to Toronto, I believe.
Yep.
To talk with you guys, maybe to do a demo.
Yep.
A dog and pony show, maybe.
Yep.
And at that, it's exactly at that point where they're coming to Toronto to see you, where we got cut off.
Well, yes, but and I will pick it up from there. But I do begin. I do talk about in the recording I have. That's in August 90, and Carolyn used it for a year till the last week of December 1991, and really liked it, and it was working on her AIDS patients and other problems. And so then that was it. We got ready to go to New York for the new study, and we had to wait a whole year, all through 92, until the funding came in. And the funding came from the nephew of the Shah of Iran. Pretty interesting who was funding this. And this is 10 years after he's evicted from Iran. Let me just check to see what year he died. I wonder if he was dead by then. Okay, so Shah of Iran. He died, wow, he died in 1980. What, does that make sense? Yeah, I remember him, the Rockefellers, brought him into America after the Khomeini took over in 79. I guess he died really quickly. So this is 10, 11, 12 years later. He is survived by his sister, who is like the dragon lady or something, rumored to be a dope dealer, and she lives in this luxurious apartment in New York. And her nephew is got money to support this new technology. So we met all these people, and they got treated by the technology. I don't think they had AIDS, but they liked what it did for them. So go ahead.
What was when they contacted you out of New York? They were doing so on the basis of your work or Carolyn's work, or
Carolyn.
What was the connection?
No, it was all medicine. The invention was for medicine, and Jim George, who's a prominent Canadian ambassador, he grew up in Ontario, and he went to Paris in 1950. He did Athens, Greece, he did India, a career of being an ambassador all over the place. And he's written a book, Jim George, G-E-O-R-G-E, James George. I forget the title. Maybe I'll come up with it. It's out in the garage, the book. In the late 60s, he was the ambassador, Canadian ambassador to India, and the Dalai Lama came to him. Because it got around that Jim George was a mystic. He was very interested in Gurdjieff, and he gets to Paris to meet Gurdjieff, but Gurdjieff had died in the middle of 49 or something, and he missed him by 6 months, but he met the heir of his work, Madame de Saltzman. So he was very involved with Gurdjieff, and then that leads to a lot of other New Age groups and stuff. And he studied Tibetan Buddhism or something, but the Dalai Lama found out about him and came to him in India and said, I have all my stuff that I took with me when I escaped from Tibet to some place in India, but it was a hot environment, and all their sacred documents, manuscripts and stuff, were melting and just dissolving. So he asked Jim to microfilm everything, on the condition that Jim didn't read it while he was doing it. The Dalai Lama did not want another human or a white person or a non-Tibetan Buddhist or something to engage it. So Jim did that. And this is before the world knew much about the Dalai Lama. And so he became a friend, insider to the Dalai Lama world in the late 60s, and as the Dalai Lama's image rose in the 80s and 90s, Jim was always on the inside. And he met a lot of other wealthy people who got into the Dalai Lama. And then these wealthy people formed a committee, and he was the chairman of it or something. And they started the anti-whaling movement. It was the Threshold Foundation. All these rich people who funded Jim and these people. Greenpeace was happening in the 70s, and I don't know how much they interacted with Greenpeace, but they made some changes in the whaling industry by the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile,
Greenpeace was also started in Canada, so there may have been that connection.
Yeah, well, Greenpeace is early 70s. I know Threshold is the late 70s. And they weren't, as far as I know, they weren't out in the boats. They did something else. Maybe they lobbied governments. They had the clout. But it's spelled out in his biography. But in between that, he was in Iran in the 70s and became very involved with the Shah of Iran's world. And then I don't know how Jim met the inventor of this device, Walter Fishman. But probably Jim brought the nephew into funding the second study. The first study was done in 87, 88, 89, 25 people. So they started taking the treatment, doing well. Then AZT got promoted by probably Dr. Fauci, our present guy in the White House. They started promoting AZT, and so let's say 12 of them dropped out of the device that Walter was doing and took AZT, and they all died. And the ones that didn't take AZT and stuck to the program, they survived and did well. So that was only 25 people. So the idea was to do a bigger study and get bigger funding, and the doctor that did the first study, it was so controversial, he didn't want anybody to know that he did it, the one who oversaw the application of it. He was nervous at the end of it, so he didn't want to be part of the second one. He wanted to go back and just be a nobody, an anonymous doctor. So they were looking for a doctor to oversee it, and Jim George was a patient of Carolyn's in Toronto. And so Jim would go back and forth to New York and Toronto, so He knew how great Carolyn was as a doctor, so he said to Walter, I think I have the person we want. So he arranged for Walter's wife, Nancy, to come and meet Carolyn in August 90, and Carolyn was shown the thing, and she actually got an injection from it, and she almost fainted from it. But she said, wow, I've never had a reaction like that from a healthy modality, apparently. So she was very intrigued. She knew that it had affected you, or affected one. So she accepted it and did it for a year, and then waited to go to New York to do the study, which started in 93. And it involved...
One thing, in what you're saying there, what's the connection between a machine and an injection? That seems
I didn't finish the description, so I'll describe the machine in a minute. But just to finish that trajectory, so to speak, so we're in 93, 94, they start a clinic. And Mario Cuomo, the governor of New York, changed the law so that people could do alternative therapies a little more. You're not so much pressured and resistance and arresting and stuff. He loosened up alternative modalities, so it was the perfect time to do MIR. It was not going to be harassed. And so that's 93, 94, 95. And by 95, I'm witnessing this incredible development. We actually have a treatment for AIDS. Now, you know, you want the world to find out about this. The miracle of it showed me there was a new kind of something, because this was not explainable by normal science, and that inspired me to make the chart. I hadn't experienced something new, you know, the positive part of the flat line. And so that's why I'm giving you the background. It's important. This thing caused the chart. And
so you were being treated interacting with this machine.
Yes, and I would hear all about it. I'd go to the lab, which was on East 65th Street. I think it was 325. If you want to look at the building, anybody listening, 325 East 65th Street. And it impressed people.
High rent.
Yeah, it impressed people that Carolyn had this incredible address. Like when we joined the Fitting's Weight Group in New York in late 93, 94, and eventually we didn't run around and say, hey, we live at 325 East 65th. Eventually they got to know us, and they'd come visit Carolyn at the lab and find out about it. And all these longtime New Yorkers said, wow, you're at the heart of the best place in New York, or the most prestigious area, you know, in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
on the east side. So there's charisma in the building. And Walter, he got it. He was a writer for Reader's Digest and Dilettante, and he went to Asia and learned acupuncture and homeopathy, all these different things. He wasn't a doctor. He was an inventor. He made gadgets and, you know, and did – did I say Reader's Digest? I meant Popular Mechanics. He wrote mm-hmm. for Popular Mechanics. So he
that's a little better.
Beg your pardon?
That's a little better.
That's right. And so he invented this thing in the middle 80s. He made it. And then he, probably because he was a charismatic guy and he'd get people to believe in him, so he got that apartment, that basement layout, for pretty well nothing. He didn't have to pay any rent hardly. So he was lucky that way. Otherwise, he couldn't have afforded it because he didn't have any regular, you know, well-paying job going. He was too much of a dilettante and doing his own thing and scraping by. His wife was a ballet teacher, but I think by the 80s, she wasn't doing that anymore. Waller was a very interesting person, but I never got to meet him. What happened was when we went to New York in February 93, Walter wanted Carolyn to go out to his branch office in L.A. first. So we went to L.A. in February 93, not New York. But if I'm not going to get into details, I just say we go to New York in February 93. We're working for New York, but we're in L.A. And so Carolyn goes back to New York while I'm staying at Jerry Fialka, his home and small cottage home in Venice, a great place. He was working for Frank Zappa, who I was a great fan of. And so we stayed there, but by April, Carolyn went back because the National Institutes of Health had heard of this technology. April 95. No, April 93. But, you know, the second study has been going along. And so in the first week, April 93, in People magazine, they had an article on the new director of the National Institutes of Health. I think that's what it's called. And he was an American Indian, or American, you know, a native. So he's an interesting character, and there's an interview with him. And that week, Walter and Carolyn went to him and the scene there and presented the mirror technology to the board there to get grants and get support. And so they presented their case, and the people at the National Institute of Health said, wow, this is great, we're going to do it. And then a voice spoke up in the back, said, no, you're not going to do it. And it was a representative of the FDA. And they were pretty police-like. Just a minute. Hello? Yeah, still going. Just checking the recording.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
But what was the word you used when you said the something technology? When you were describing the machine or describing the therapy or something, and you called it the something technology, but I didn't pick up on
that. No, it was not important. I haven't described it yet. But the point is that the FDA's representative was at the meeting, and they objected to supporting this crazy technology.
Sure.
And they stopped it. So mm-hmm. it showed the power of the FDA. What?
They probably weren't. They probably didn't care about the technology or anything that was actually going on. What they cared about was the turf battle.
That's right.
Right. That.
Yep. Exactly.
They always, between the NIH and the FDA, there's always a contest between who has authority over whatever is going on.
That's right. And so they were didn't get their grants or whatever, but they still were doing their second study. So they go back to New York, and Carolyn stays there a couple of weeks and then comes in and stays at Jerry's through, say, the middle of April into May and June. And then Carolyn gets a call out of the blue, and Hillary is visiting Hillary Clinton. You know, she's first lady. She's visiting Hawaii, I think it was. And Walter and the woman who was guiding Hillary around the island, whatever island it was a former worker for the lab. And she says, I have a great opportunity to tell Hillary about this technology. And, you know, this is in that period when, you know, nobody knows what to do about AIDS. It's very bad. They don't have a solution. So so the lady, Walter, gave, we'll just call her Karen, Carolyn's phone number, and called and said, I'm going to be with Hillary in a couple hours. How can I explain the technology? So Carolyn dictated a statement for her to make, because she didn't have the clues about it to say it. So Carolyn rehearsed the woman for Hillary, and then when Hillary showed up, the lady, former nurse or whatever, demonstrated it and talked it up the way Carolyn said. So that was interesting. Nothing came of it, but it was a dramatic intervention sort of potential there. And then, let's see, in June, okay, so she's there in April. She goes back in June, and I think this Hillary thing happened in July. But in June, Walter taught Carolyn how to make the secret herbal formulas. And that was really lucky, because Walter was going to be dead 2 months later. So anyways, Carolyn stays in New York for a month in June and then comes back to L.A. through July. And then they have this Hillary incident. And then she has to, she goes back to New York in the 1st of August, and then on August 12th, I'm getting ready to go to New York, finishing up with Jerry, because he had a friend coming to stay, a girlfriend from Paris, and so it was just a new relationship, so I was going to have to leave, so that was okay. So a couple of days before I was going to leave, on August 12th, I get a call from Carolyn, and Walter had just dropped dead. Now, it might have been under the disappointment or the frustration of getting so close to having it recognized, and then it didn't happen. So I flew back to Toronto to check out the people staying in our home there, and then I went down to New York and got there a week later, and then we started living in New York. And we stayed there. So for me, I show up, you know, like August 22nd in 93, and we're there for 15 years till June 2008. Okay, so that's the background of the inspiration for the chart, which, if the chart is important, you got to know where it came from. Okay, so how I organized it was this device, and I only got half of it talked about when it disconnected on my recording. So you take a herb and you potentize it, which means you make it a liquid, what is called homeopathy. Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
You're diluting it so that there's a very tiny memory of the herb in the liquid part.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the potentized herb. Then you take that liquid and you put it in a syringe needle. Then you lay the syringe needle in a little plastic flat device that you could put a needle in, but it has a bit of electrical thing inside it, so some circuitry. So when you inject the needle in an acupuncture point, so you've got herbs, homeopathy, and acupuncture here, you inject the needle into the acupuncture point, and as the solution goes into the acupuncture point, you zap it electrically. And that's what the little, it's like a little cell phone, a little flat thing, you know what I mean? A little smartphone, a modern phone today. And it had the hole, the pathway to lay the needle in. Okay, so you're spinning electrical effects on a combination of acupuncture, herbs, and homeopathy. Quite a brilliant thing. And it worked on all kinds of problems, and especially AIDS. So that was a technology. So I'm there 2 years later, and I'm thinking about this technology and how we're going to introduce it to the world. And I don't know how I say, okay, there's Marshall McLuhan. You talk about me doing a lot of work. I did a lot of work and a lot of people and distilled it down to four people, maybe six, of studying intently these people, not just McLuhan. So you've got Lyndon LaRouche, Mae Brussel, McLuhan, Zappa, Jay Krishnamurti, William Irwin Thompson, Dr. Beter, and my mentor back in Halifax, Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, Garrett Dean. So I was thinking these four levels, but I added Croker to it. So the four levels were LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, and myself. And I said, okay, each one of these guys helped to conceptualize the unfolding of MIR. And MIR was the name for the technology. It stood for Molecularly Influenced Herbal Remedies or Magnetically Influenced Homeopathic Remedies. They altered it, you know what I mean? And I can't remember
so
what...
So it's M-I-H-R?
Yeah, yeah, capital M, capital I, capital H, capital R. And
was it intended as to suggest mirror?
I don't know if he no, it was the space station, MIR, the Russian...
Uh-huh.
Space station.
Yeah.
He was reflecting that. Now there's the satellite, you know, laser beam level. You know, he was thinking of a space thing, some important futuristic or a symbol of something, and I'm sure that's why I make the bottom level have the satellite in there. You know, MIR is embedded in there secretly, so to speak. Even though satellites have to be there because they're the next technology. But yes, MIR, I was punning on it in my mind, my organizing of the data. I had my own idiosyncratic imagery, so to speak. So
In Russian, MIR means world, I believe.
MIR?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I might have known that back then. But yeah, I said molecularly influenced. I think it's magnetically influenced herbal or homeopathic remedies. So meanwhile, Walter's getting it patented, and he managed in that period to get it patented. And Malcolm Forbes, the father of Stephen Forbes, the original guy, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
He was gay, and he had a gay lover. And he brought the gay lover to Walter, and Walter fixed him, got rid of the AIDS for all intents and purposes. So Malcolm Forbes, you know, he's getting old, and he wants to make a big splash. So he gets his friend Liz Taylor involved, and they are going to promote the second study once it's completed. So Walter is really, you know, doing well at this point. This is 90, 91, 92. Everything's looking good. And then, but he wanted to get a famous patient. So they made overtures to Magic Johnson, who's on my chart. And Johnson, it never got clarified whether he had it done or not. he wanted to keep all his AIDS reality secret or something. But he survived and did well. And we didn't know that would have happened before Walter died. And Walter never told Carolyn what happened with him. And that might have been the deal, not to tell anybody what Magic Johnson was doing, because it was very scandalous. He got in trouble anyways for doing other remedies for his AIDS, which might have been a metaphor for, or a red herring for Mir. He said, yes, I had alternative things and they worked, but he never named Mir. He named something else. So it was all complicated. So getting him to promote the thing didn't really work, but he did get helped. That's 90. So Walter dies August 12th. I show up a week or so later, and then the law gets changed. So Walter's wife and Carolyn open a clinic, and while doing a study on people. So that went well for three years till 97. But then the American Medical Association got wind of all this, and they, in New York, they're like a mafia kind of thing. They'll sabotage you. They sabotaged or overrode Mary Cuomo's law, and they prevented Carolyn from sending the Mir needles across the country. They couldn't get it out of the state. So it was quarantined in New York. So that made it pretty limited. And so the operation diminished. There wasn't much business happening. There were people in New York doing it, and the study was going forward, but they had a lot bigger ambitions. So Carolyn decided to put her time into something else. So she decided to, she was taking classes on Chinese herbs. So the kid who taught the Chinese herbs, we would call it a cult, but it was part of Chinese culture. He had a special way of doing herbs, and it was passed on through the generations, like the Dalai Lama is. And so this kid was part of this lineage. It went back centuries. And so Carolyn studied his stuff and then went to Random House and said, hey, let's do a book on this unique Chinese medicine. And they said, we just did a book, but we have a book here, a proposal on magnesium. What do you think of this? And so Carolyn didn't know anything about magnesium. So she looked into it, met the scientists who had done 25 years of studies with all kinds of great results and no interest in the scientific world. So Carolyn took on the book, and the book came out in 99, and she got on The View. You know that show?
Yes.
Yeah, so
I've never seen it, but it's like four or five women, isn't it?
Right. It was run, the main woman at that time was Barbara Walters, who was famous. So she was on the show a lot for 3 years to 2002. Then the government passed a law that drug companies can advertise on TV directly to people, no policing of it or something. So that caused a bonanza for drug therapies, and they told The View that they can't have Carolyn on because she gets on and talks about these alternatives to drugs, and then they go to a drug commercial. So it conflicted from what the drug companies wanted, so they asked Barbara and them not to have her on anymore, and they followed that because I guess they needed the money from the drug company. So that ended Carolyn's TV career, and the Mir faded off. No opportunity to do it anymore. So that led to a bunch of interesting things she looked into. I won't go into it. And it eventually led to our breakthrough stuff. And why it's a breakthrough is it's pico-sized. She found a guy that could take the mineral magnesium and make it so tiny that it gets in the cells. And if you get magnesium in the cells, you don't get diarrhea. And it has tremendous effects. And no one had ever put magnesium on the cellular level into the cell. It made a tremendous effect. So that became a big success story. So it's led to our products are as good as mirror. And that was partly helped by ION, which showed up to me in March 18th, 2009. I evoked this man, have a voice come through him. So that's another story. And that's, you know, that's 16 years later after arriving in New York and 9 months after we came to Hawaii in June 2008. Okay, so that's what my opening thoughts are. So now we got to look at what I developed from that on the chart.
And so did you get injected or inoculated, whatever the term is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I took the shots regularly.
Times?
I didn't have any problem.
Oh, regularly. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't. But it would give you extra energy or something. It had a good effect.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't have AIDS or anything or...
Right.
I was.
But you weren't. You. I don't think you were deficient in energy.
No, I wasn't. I was healthy, and it made me healthier.
Okay. Good. But it helped. But it seems like it had what at least what you considered to be a psychological effect, or not psychological, cognitive.
Had all kinds of great effects. It was holistic. It affected everything in oneself. And I'd always been a guinea pig for Carolyn since the late 60s, early 70s. She was looking alternative therapies before she became got into medicine. But I always was, she'd try stuff out on me. And when she was in med school in 75, 74 to 78, in Halifax at Dalhousie University, she found a guy who taught acupuncture, which was pretty rare. Nixon had just brought it over in 71, 72 when he went to China, and that was new stuff for Americans. So Carolyn did acupuncture on me back in 75 in Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. And so that was neat. And I got guinea pigged all kinds of therapies, alternative therapies. So it was natural for me to do mirror. And I am the remarkable person I am today due to that. Thanks to the mirror. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're supposed to laugh there. You're supposed to laugh when I said remarkable person.
What I understood from the story before is that mirror... in your consideration, it was very successful, but because of external factors, it sort of never took off, and then it didn't play much of a role with you personally anymore after that either.
Right. Carolyn, when she was getting on The View and getting her book out, The Miracle of Magnesium, it was always with the agenda, well, I'll get some attention this way, then I'll be able to talk about mirror. But it never got to that level because she got kicked off TV, and the wife was getting a little depressed about it all, that it didn't take off as soon as she wanted it to do. So the energy for it just dissipated. And then 9/11 happened, okay, 2001. That sucker punched New Yorkers. What I noticed in New York, a malaise took over the city, and it never recovered. I knew a lot of people who knew people who had died in the towers. So New York became a depressed place. And by 2007, we were thinking of moving somewhere. And Hawaii was not in our mind. But I won't go into how we ended up there. But it was a great move.
Another day we'll do that. That'd be an interesting story.
Yes, so the world changed after 9/11. So that took the energy out of the Mirror project too. So what else? We continued to do. I always could take the mirror stuff. We continue to apply to ourselves and other people. You know, what's interesting, the Sacklers are, they own some big drug company or something. And they
Purdue.
Have, you might know the name, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so the Sackler, their daughter, who might have been in her 40s or something, they had a whole room section in the museum, what is it, Metropolitan Museum of New York or whatever it's called, the one over on Fifth Avenue, Metropolitan Museum of Art, I think it is.
Yeah.
So the daughter of the Sackler oligarchy in Big Pharma was a patient of Carolyn's at 325 E60 Vix and took Mir and knew what it could do. But she never helped the project. She just took it selfishly. She didn't want to undermine her own income from her drug company, which we would obsolesce if we got out there. Right? A lot of things wouldn't have fixed up. Okay, I'm looking at Malcolm Forbes. He dies in February 1990. So that's a few months before Carolyn's going to hear about it. So that took a bit of wind out of it, but wasn't that bad because the Shah took over. Liz Taylor was still interested. But then Walter died in 93. So they had to recover from that. And they lasted 4 years and then wasn't so good in terms of spreading because the AMA said you can't send this to other states. And in some ways, Carolyn was up against...
The business model...
What?
The business model was to try to interest people in using the mechanism.
Yeah, it was to get a big name. This is what Walter wanted to do, get a big name to promote it. Otherwise,
that's right. But there's different possible business models. One business model would be to sell the machine, as it were. But you could also have a business model where you would kind of franchise clinics.
That was the goal.
And that would be that would get around the export problem because people would have to come to New York to be trained and then they would be able to take the equipment not as something being sold across state lines, but as personal property back to wherever they were going to do the practice. So, and there were other possible business models. But we did do that one.
So they did start in 94. They had many seminars and people came and learned it. But one guy went up to Alaska, another one back to L.A., but they didn't do it well, or they couldn't do it, or they screwed it up. It never really got going. And so that was a drag. And but Carol thought, well, okay, can't be impatient. Maybe in 5 or 10 years we'll be able to do it if she got a higher profile. And she was on her way to getting a higher profile. But it didn't work in the long run. It faded off. So Malcolm Forbes died in 1990. Let's see, when did Liz Taylor die?
Oh, much later.
Yeah, probably another 10 years. Oh, yeah, 2011. But she wasn't around after Malcolm died very much. So we did get – the Mellons are a famous family on the level of the Rockefellers, and one of their daughters – they're a huge family. One of their daughters became a friend of ours, and she took the treatment. And so she was another possibility – but she got too involved with the Dalai Lama and what was called the Tibet House, so she didn't do anything. So for some reason, it never really got the attention it should have. But where we are today is way better than that. That's a bulky thing compared to what we have now.
But it contributed, it got you thinking in sort of more commercial terms.
Also got me thinking more cosmically. I mean, what if someone showed up and gave you... you know, perfect energy device. It's okay, Cameron, present it to the world. Okay, first thing, you have to deal with the oil companies. They won't like you doing this, and they'll try to kill you. Anyways, mm-hmm. it made me think on a bigger level of responsibility about this thing. You know what I mean? I had a lot of time to think about it. I wasn't doing it to anybody. I wasn't the doctor. Mm-hmm. But I was watching this unfold, and I thought it might work. And I used to, mm-hmm. when I was interviewed for Bosmia Ecology and that, I would talk about what we had and that we were going to cure AIDS and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but you had always, unless I'm mistaken, you had always had a sense of a kind of mission, right?
Yeah, we both did.
What's that?
We both did. We always, we used to call it back in the late 60s, early 70s, the great work. We knew we were going to do the great work, whatever it is. Whatever we thought it was. I went through many different inspirational places, like going to McLuhan. There's a guy who had a big view. He was someone that you had to be differently around. You had to think differently. You know, he couldn't be a little person with little mind and little stupid issues. And I was attracted to all kinds of geniuses, and they became names on my chart. So I always was looking to do something huge. That was just natural, and so did Carolyn. But we were very casual about it. We weren't maniacs. We had a good disposition about it, a good sense of humor about it all. But it was always there. We knew we were going to do something. But when you have a treatment for AIDS in the middle of that crisis, that's quite a responsibility, or you got to be careful you don't go crazy in that situation, you know? Think you're superior or get mad because nobody's listening. Stuff like that. We had to be cool about it. So
sure.
Definitely that made me think bigger or something. And it produced this chart. You know, I had arrived here's the thing I had arrived at. So I'm thinking about the parts from the mirror machine. Then I'm thinking of all the geniuses I had met and wondered how did they influence our destiny to get there, to get to where we had gotten in mid-90s. And what was the other thing? So I decided that the patriarchy, okay, when in 99 I interviewed Peggy Hitchcock about her life, which was pretty amazing, and her mother came through. I got her to be interviewed by a psychic, to have a session with a psychic lady. It was pretty good. And her mother came through and told her that the era of men was over. Men had blown it. The patriarchy was gone. And women are going to take over. Now, that was said in 99. That's 4 years after the chart. But I somehow had that idea that Carolyn represented a breakthrough where women could take over science with this new technology, a new kind of knowledge. So my chart was the history of the patriarchy, and then something happens that ends the patriarchy. So I was my joke part of the chart was I was making a list of the best people that women should pay attention to if they're taking over. So I consider myself the last guy, and I knew enough to accept the transition, but I knew that the women wouldn't know what I knew, especially from McLuhan and Finnis Wake, and they need to know that. So the chart was meant to be a celebration of people that the women, whoever they are, that, quote, take over, they need to study. The best that men had to produce. It wasn't all a complete waste of time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep.
So that was another level that went into thinking of it. And then it just got more and more involved because then I said, okay, these people are actually machinic. They're media. And I knew from Eric's thesis that people in Finnis Wake were media. Like they could be a radio or a TV. HCE was a radio transmitter on page like 308 or something in Finnis Wake, the beginning of the chapter after the school classroom book. Yeah, it was about 308, I think, 309. AC is described as a radio. And a key quote in that section is in War and Peace in the Global Village. So I started to cyborg my characters. And then I was saying, well, women are taking over because the environments changed people. And so I wanted to show the evolution of the electric phases. And I matched the different people to different phases. So LaRouche is a Marxist. That's what he was. And then he updated Marxism with a semi-McLuhan understanding of technology as the ground. So he made a very interesting new kind of economics. But that's the 19th century world, I considered him. So if you look on the chart, he represents 1840 to 1900. And it's crystallized as 1947 to 57, focused on 1960. And this chart is from 1960 to 1990, and it is the Android meme as hidden ground, and then the Android meme surfaces in the mid-90s as the Internet, or the information highway. So I said, I'm making a picture of the background to the 90s environment, but the environment is a figure, and it's ground from 60 to 90. Okay, so that was another structural point. And so
let me just make sure I understand here. You were talking about Lyndon LaRouche in the
19th century.
In the, 1840 to 1900. And then you jumped to the PENTAD
level
portion, 1960 to 1990. And you're saying that this 100 years later is the ground of...
I jumped ahead. I have to go back and redo it better for you. The chart is going to be a picture of the Internet, but the Internet was an after image of the Android meme, which was grown from 1960 to 1990. The digital world was grown out of MIT. There's different companies. Read any history. MIT was doing stuff in the late 60s and late 50s, early 60s, and there's a progression of companies taking it over, coming up to 1969 when they did the first Internet connection between UCLA and maybe the University in Utah or something, or in Berkeley. I get them mixed up. It's either Berkeley or
– Yeah, I think it's Berkeley.
Right. And it's the week of September, first week of September 69, and the first message is an incomplete – It becomes L-O. I think they were typing in hello, and it just got to be L-O, low, like the magician's wand.
And, like a replay of Alexander Graham Bell.
Yes, yeah. So, and then every month, the first week of the month, they'd add another connection, and they went across, four or five universities across the country. Mm-hmm. I think it ended up at MIT. But... that was being built, and then that would blossom in the 90s with Mosaic in 93 and then Netscape, and Tim Berners-Lee inventing the HTML in 91. So I had all that history. So I was trying to process what everybody was trying to do in the mid-90s. What the hell is this thing that gets everybody talking to everybody, right? It's quite a Internet was quite a surprise for everybody. And, of course, I knew what McLuhan had said, and later they say, he predicted the Internet. So I had a lot of these good thoughts from my studies that were worth putting into order. The main McLuhan aspect is the hidden environment is being built and no one notices it, and then when it's obsolete, it becomes the figure, and everybody notices it. So the digital work that was being done in universities and all over the place from 60 to 90, completed in 1990, and I have other reasons why I completed 1990, and then we had the after image. So I considered the Internet an after image. So that was a conscious understanding of what the picture was going to be. But I had to deal with all the different knowledge forms from 1840 to 1960, the analog media history, right? I was going to do, mm-hmm. I'm doing the analog. And so I considered LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, myself, as after images of the ground of analog technology development. So now let's look at the chart. Let's look at some of the words here.
Well, Bob, I think we're getting close to the end because I'm going to have to sign off in the next 5 minutes or so. I wonder if, am I correct in thinking that what you're setting out is a number of different sort of structural
levels,
principles that went into how the chart was conceived and assembled.
Yep.
So you have the history of technology idea. You have the handing on to the matriarchy idea. You have the mirror idea somehow in here. By the way, at one point you talked about the parts of mirror, and I didn't know what you meant when you said the parts of mirror.
Yeah, that's the herbs, the homeopathy,
the
magnetic, and the acupuncture. So let me tell you, if I remember it right, I think Thompson, who was a New Age guru and talked about Gaia, I think he was herbs. LaRouche was technology, so he was the magnetic, electrical magnetic part. McLuhan was acupuncture, because I have him interacting with China, and he says China is the new ground in the 60s. And then Croker would have to be the homeopathic process. That's right. See, the homeopathic process is what John Baudrillard talked about. He saw technology being homeopathized, and so did McLuhan in one sentence back in the 50s. So the parts were hardware technology, that's LaRouche, and he represented technological liberalism. McLuhan represented Catholicism and Thomism in particular, so he was acupuncture, and I had some thinking about, I don't know, through the vantage point or some aspect of McLuhan's thinking expressed acupuncture. And then the Earth's idealism, it was Thompson, that's herbs. And then Croker is the homeopathic process. He developed it from Baudrillard. And then I was the integration of them all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was the effect.
I like the idea of McLuhan as acupuncture, because acupuncture has a number of different nodes. And you the acupuncture system, you could say, is a network, right? And
yes.
So McLuhan can be a probe, can be conceived as a acupuncture needle, which needs to be placed in the proper part of the network in order to pay off.
Yes, you'll see that McLuhan has the category rhizome in it. And that's like the meridians, that acupuncture through the body, you know, the rhizome, the subterranean spreading out of the strawberry plant is in
that's
the
root.
Central nervous system.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and that's great for McLuhan, because I personally, I think at his best, he's talking about media as roots, as principles.
Yeah. I was just thinking, I think his probing, stinging people with manipulating satire, that might have been part of it, the needle part.
Mm-hmm.
It should come
needling.
Back. Yeah, needling. And what did he say? Doesn't he have a famous quote with the word needles in it? He has that one, the buzzsaw of technology. Why do people put their hands in the buzzsaw of technology, or, you know, they embrace new technology and then their hands get cut off.
There's something about the teeth of the saw.
Yeah, but there, I don't know if that's the right quote, but there was something in McLuhan, a quote that fit. But anyways, I haven't thought about the stuff too much in that part, you know. I do remember Herb's and LaRouche's magnetism, electrical magnetism and electromagnetism, and Croker is easy. He's homeopathic because it comes from Baudrillard. But I can't remember the angle that made it very appropriate that McLuhan was acupuncture, but you're getting parts of it. May not be exactly what I was thinking, but it works. So let's leave it. And then those are going to become environments, which is the satellite is the ground, but it's being processed. So I have homeopathic radio, homeopathic television, that's McLuhan, radio is LaRouche, computer is Thompson, homeopathic satellite is Croker. So that's the cyborg part. You know what I mean? And there is a gap between the human and the technology, but a visual map might make people think they're joined. See, it fosters linear connections. So the chart is biased. It's a biased view of the Android meme as figure. So I'm going to explain to you what I would do if I made a video out of it. It'd be very different. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but maybe we have to just start next time with an explanation of, you know, what...
That was a lot of stuff.
I
got to explain the dating.
Yeah, and then there's the... why the triad comes before the dyad.
Yeah.
It seems so.
That's important. To say, since the Android meme actually was a replay after the satellite, it was moving out of the human dimension or analog media. So McLuhan and Croker and Thompson are not the ground. The ground is the vortices. So LaRouche redoes Ezra Pound. McLuhan redoes Lewis. Thompson redoes T.S. Eliot. Croker redoes W.B.H. and I redo Joyce. You're thinking I'm the integrator, that's the fitting is wake. So that's what's going on here. You'll see how they're a replay of when it was still unfolding, the analog media evolution. So that's really interesting.
I remember in your book, I can't remember its name, the one with the blue cover.
Fatty Communion.
That's right, Fatty Communion, absolutely. So the four figures in there are the four figures you're talking about here in the chart, right?
Yep. The book was done in 92 before the chart, but it's the effect preceding the cause. That's the contents of the important quotes of each one of them.
Right. And then you, in 99 or 98, I can't remember when it was that we met at Mark's place.
98.
You gave me that book.
Ah, now it's purple cover, not blue, purple.
Ah, well, there you go. I have that in the garage somewhere along with the...
with the flip side. You got a Bob box. Maybe you get a Bob box.
That's right. Absolutely.
But look for it when you get a chance. If it's not too difficult. But so we just begun. It becomes incredibly complicated and encyclopedic. I built on it, you know. It didn't take me very long, a week or something, to think it through. But I had everything was ready to spill out. And so I have to explain the beginning at the top, Rye, Eloy, Too Lofty, and Bob. Okay?
That's
the beginning point. So...
obviously a basketball team.
Which one? You're saying the players, the names refer to basketball? Yeah, five players.
No, I'm just joking on the fact that there's five of them.
Well, there is. Will Chamberlain's in the chart.
There you go.
But the thing is, the Android
Magic
meme,
Johnson.
Yeah, are you looking at it?
No.
Yeah, Matt and Magic Johnson. He's down there.
mentioned them before.
With Wayne Gretzky, and there's a reason for that. But the so a certain bigger view that we can end with is the Android meme is post-analogical media, which ended with the satellite, which was an extension of the planet after doing all our faculties. So that was a completion. And then we went into this weird world of the digital, which is, I would say, machines extending themselves, not our faculties, and not the planet. So the McLuhan and all them are after images, no, replays, cliche probes of the when it was real back in the 1910s and 20s, when people mattered, before you get the end of history in 1945, those guys are the ground of the analog media. And so they get replayed, and each one of them represents, LaRouche represents 10 years, 47 to 57, crystallized in 1960. McLuhan represents 57 to 67, crystallized in 1965. Thompson is 67 to 72, crystallized in 1970. That's when Earth Day started, and he was part of that world. And then Croker is 72 to 77, crystallized in 1980, and that's when Reagan, the virtual president, comes in. And that's the postmodern era. So that's how you read the dates within the structure in the middle of it. Okay?
Yeah. I'm just trying to look up something here that you might be interested in as a sign on. This is in Media and the Inflation Crowd.
Yeah.
An essay that was in George Sanderson's Annie Ganishka review and then in his book. And apparently it was written in the 60s, but didn't get published until the 80s.
What was it called?
So, the essay, Media and the Inflation Crowd.
Right, right. Whereas the one, the great one in 74 is a media approach to inflation. This was before
right.
that. I think it got written in 73. I have the original, you know, Xerox typing thing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
You know, all of these, excuse me, I got a frog in my throat here. All of these late essays are basically thrown together out of earlier notes,
yes.
Some of which were published, some of them not. And then the interesting stuff always comes in the middle where he joined up the fragments that came from another time.
Yes.
But anyway, here in Media and the Inflation Crowd, he says that this is a quote from McLuhan, Sputnik, October 4th, 1957, and its successors represent something quite different, namely an extension of the planet itself, creating new ground for man in the sky and calling despotically for a new equilibrium and harmony of action and knowledge. I think I may have read that in one of our earlier conversations.
Yeah, last week.
But it still, yeah, it still seems to me to capture what we're talking about.
Yeah, the process, the holy, the, you know, and it's late, what, the Sputnik and it's later, what's the phrase?
Sputnik and its successors,
successors
created something quite different, namely an extension of the planet itself, creating a new ground for man in the sky.
Right.
And calling despotic. Sorry?
Yeah, no, and despotic. But that is, I knew that essay back then, and I'm sure
yeah.
that was part of my thinking in the
Maybe.
Homeopathic process.
Well, this, but the not only the new ground in the sky is a big theme in your thinking,
yeah.
but this calling despotically for a new equilibrium and harmony of action and knowledge, that's the demand that has increasingly been made since 1945 and has now reached a crescendo.
Yeah.
If we don't find
it's reached
the new
lockdown
equilibrium.
Proportions. Look at this COVID thing. It's a global lockdown.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff that's happened with me, Carolyn, and Ion that the chart predicted. That'll be interesting. But that'll be I'm not going into that till way down there, down the road.
Yeah.
But it's pretty interesting what has unfolded. And this chart anticipated, caused it, something, you know?
All right.
So the...
Well, we'll start to take that up in detail next time, Bob.
Yes. Well, we may not get to that pack thing, but no, there's a whole talk I got to give of how this... I got to explain a lot of the encyclopedic part of it and why it's
right.
This way. And I forgot to say that after Coker, 72 to 77, crystallized in 1980, the Dobbs quadrant is 77 to 90 or 92. I put 92 in there, but it could be 90. But anyways, it crystallizes in 1990. That's when the walls fall. You know, the the European Berlin wall.
Berlin. Yeah.
And other walls. So... so that's why it's 1990, and it started with Roush in 1960 as replays of 1840 to 1945, 1959.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what's interesting to me in this stuff is the deliteralization of the names and the events.
Yeah.
Right, your thinking jumps around, and that's the interesting part of it to me, how the jumps are made, what the rhythm is, what
yes.
the jazz is of your thinking. But I think if anybody were to go to the chart and were to say, okay, here's Magic Johnson and Gretzky. And so that means the person of Magic Johnson and the person of Gretzky. I think they're just approaching it wrongly.
That's right.
They have to ask themselves, how are these names and these events representative?
In each quadrant. How are they resonant with each section?
Yeah, yeah. So
that's very good.
The first thing you have to do is deliteralize and... try to understand the rhythm and the boom of these things.
Yes, exactly. Because this is a swirling at the bottom. It says Orphic Baroque spirals. This is a spiraling, what do you call that thing? Gyroscope? Gyroscope.
Gyroscope, yeah, absolutely.
Gyroscopic action. All kinds of stuff that would be quite a video. If I ever got the time or situation to make it, but is a total lie. The Dobbs formula chart is visually biased and meant to be that way. It's sequential, but this tiny note is the big now, with all these levels, resonance, and spheres interacting, interpolating, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the last words on the chart is danced, and there's
dance. Yes, dance. The hex
advertising going on here from that needs to be understood. What we talked about today are the structural membranes of the thing
of the decade dance, which is at the top. Yeah, dance is probably the only, the word bacteria is repeated, but dance is one of the few words repeated. Well, no, homeopathic is repeated.
Where's the decade dance? I don't see that.
At the very top, the Zenocrinus Bob's tiny note equals the Grand Wazoo's decade dance.
Oh, there it is. Yeah.
And then you got the cyclotron, you know. There's a lot of spinning going on there. So it's actually very interesting, the whole thing, when you talk about its parts.
Good. Well, we'll get into that next time.
Okay. All right. Your interpretation
Bob, thank you.
Yes, and your interpretation is very smart and very helps me explain it.
Good.
Well, your ES, your second sight is getting the explanation from my brain. You're picking
well,
up on it.
I'm trying to be a mimesis of a great interviewer in Hawaii. I'm trying to interview you in a way that brings the stuff out.
Yeah, you're doing a good job. Okay. So thank you very much, and we'll talk next week.
All right.
Okay, bye.
Bye.